of the tabernacle has been completed, and the deacons have sated themselves on whatever dessert. Well, most folk, a lot of folks don't get dessert because of the way the deacons behave. And they've all made their way upstairs. And I will call, brethren and sisters, upon the minister of music to come forward and minister to us with the offertory hymn. With every head bowed and every eye closed, except that one little crack you got to keep open to see when the plate's being passed by you, we will pass the evening offertory plate. There is a tiny little button, apparently very hard to find, in the bottom of the offering plate that says PayPal, hallelujah, glory. Far behind we are on meeting the church, meeting the church's needs in its building program. I ain't kidding, we're far behind for the month of October. So if you would use, as the plate comes around, don't make change in the collection plate. It's not seen as worthy in the eyes of the Lord. But as the plate comes around, if you just use that little PayPal button, or written underneath it is the snail mail address, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, West Virginia, 25801. Use either one and tithe so that the horn may continue to broadcast next month. Can you do it, brethren and sisters? Hallelujah. I have faith that you can. So with every eye closed and every head bowed, except for that little winking you got to do to see the plate coming around, I will call upon the minister of music to come forward and minister to us, hallelujah, glory, in our opening hymn. Brother, please.
Heavenly Father, we thank you tonight for all your blessings. You said in all things give thanks. So we want to thank you tonight for these mighty machines that you've brought before us. Thank you for the Dodges and the Toyotas. Thank you for the Fords. And most of all, we thank you for Rousey Jennings Parker to give us the power that we see before us tonight. Thank you for Tim and for Thomas and Collins and R07 engines. Thank you for Snowball Racing Field and Goodyear Tires that bring performance and power.
Quit fiddling around out in the vestibule. Don't bother trying to munch on them 25-year-old butter candies sitting in that candy dish. Chase them deacons on into the sanctuary and away from all the sinners out there a-smoking in the parking lot. Ha! Glory! This is the horn. It is prayer meeting Wednesday, and I am Brother Bob Kincaid, Arch Pope Ultimate Imam, Superior Rabbi, Animated Animist, Shameless Shaman, glory, hallelujah. Come on down that blood red aisle and fall on your knees at the altar and put your hands, brethren and sisters, put your hands on the subwoofer and feel the glory. Feel the healing rays of common sense a flowing through you from the server on high. Glory, hallelujah. It is prayer meeting Wednesday on the horn, brethren and sistren. Yes, indeedy. Where do we begin? I'll tell you where we begin, brethren and sistren. We begin here in West Virginia, almost level, where a woman has filed suit against a Texas church. claiming that its leaders should have known. And really, they should. Come on. Claiming that its leaders should have known that the church's head pastor had a history of raping before they let him travel to West Virginia. That's where he allegedly raped her in his car before he then committed suicide in prison several days later. You may recall the story. We covered it here on the Horn. Yes, indeed, that church should have known. Knew or should have known, and that will be, of course, the standard. We're talking about Brother Matthew Jarrell, servant of the Lord, head pastor of the Open Door, of course, Baptist Church of Mesquite, Texas, naturally. He had a lot of problems. He enticed this particular woman into his Dodge pick-em-up truck, owned by the church, I might add, drove her to a remote area in Sissonville in Kanawha County, West Virginia, where he sexually assaulted and raped her. Yes, indeed, the church knew or should have known. He had a rap sheet, you see. He was arrested in 2007 after another woman accused him of forcing her to have sex. He was arrested in Baltimore in 2003 for trying to pick up a prostitute who turned out to be an undercover police officer. Whoopsie. He served 18 months on probation on a handgun charge in connection to the alleged sexual assault. There's only one problem. And I don't know if it's a problem. But the fact of the matter is, if this case is heard in Texas, it may never come, the woman may never see a dime. Sad, sad, sad. Do you know why? Let me tell you. You remember that story coming out of Texas a couple of years ago about the young woman who had had an exorcism performed upon her by her church? She was beneath the age of consent. She was not a full-on adult. And so she couldn't sue in her own right at the time, but they held her down, they restrained her, they beat her to beat the devil out of her. And when she became an adult, able to sue in her own right, she sued that nasty, filthy church and obtained judgment against them for the battery and the false imprisonment that they had inflicted upon her. As you might expect, because that's exactly what it was. It was battery and it was false imprisonment. You can't just go around doing that kind of thing. And the case went all the way to the Texas Supreme Court. And therein, the Texas Supreme Court, that bastion of justice, held that the young woman could not have a remedy at law against that church, because for the courts to impose a judgment against the church on behalf of the young woman that members of that church had restrained, assaulted, and beaten would be a violation of the church's freedom of religion. That's how bad it is in Texas. Texas is, you know, maybe a half a notch away from being Iran, only with Jesus. Yeah, let that sink in. The Texas Supreme Court held that the young woman could not get a judgment against a church that held her down, falsely imprisoned her, assaulted her, and beat her because to do so would violate the church's First Amendment rights. Never mind hers. Mother. And that's, you know, under principles of stare decisis, that's the law. In Texas, Stan. Do you believe it? And so, this individual has filed suit. And if the case is heard in Texas, her claims may be moot. Now, it's possible that the case, since the rape took place in West Virginia and her domicile is in West Virginia and his was in Texas, it may be a matter of what is called diversity jurisdiction in the federal courts. Or perhaps she has sued in state court. That much is not clear. It's a little journalism problem inside the story itself. And she might be able to get some sort of judgment. Perhaps via the insurance coverage that theoretically the church should be carrying. Yes, even churches carry insurance. Faith goes only so far. But if... and it is speculative, I admit. If that case were to be heard in the civil, loosely applied, justice system of the state of Texas, she'd be toast, even though she was raped. Because in the state of Texas, the Supreme Court has declared that rapists and kidnappers, assaulters, and batterers are virtually immune from suit as long as they do it for Jesus. Tough way to begin, huh? Well, it doesn't get any easier. Last night in my conversation with Albert, I made mention, we made mention in the course and context of our conversation of the Rick Bro-Fro Mix Santorum, who said that being made sport of in a Saturday Night Live skit was bullying, just like what happens to gay teenagers. Yes, he said he was bullied by Saturday Night Live. Now, the Rick Santorum character, as Albert noted, appeared in the skit, maybe 2.5 seconds? It was all about the Repiglican debate. And, for instance, Ron Paul was in an empty parking garage. Michelle Bachmann and Newt Gingrich were in a janitor's closet. And Rick Santorum was in a gay bar on Castro Street in San Francisco. The Andy What's-His-Face played Rick Santorum, and I think it was one line was, "Very funny!" With a bunch of leather-clad guys dancing around him and, you know, rubbing up on him. But Santorum said being mocked like that was being bullied, thereby denigrating and making sport, making light of the scores of young people in this country who have been driven to take their lives by their own hand, by their classmates, their peers, and their communities because of the way that the Christians, God, made them. And in the course of that conversation, I mentioned a young man named Jamie Hubley, read from his Facebook page, his suicide note. 15 years old. Not content to have the blood of innocence, another innocent, on its hands, these upstanding, fine, God-fearing Christians and one in particular, Bill Keller, from a website called liveprayer.com, decided to grind the pain in just a little bit more. He posted a statement about young Jamie Hubley's death on the website. He said that the death of Jamie Hubley was upon the hands of, quote, the homosexual community and media who promote his lifestyle to society, including Anderson Cooper, Rachel Maddow, Ellen DeGeneres. Homosexuality is a bondage like alcohol, drugs, gambling, or anything else people get addicted to. The fact is, suicide is exponentially higher among those who choose the homosexual lifestyle. And while those in the media want to blame people like myself who take a biblical stand on the issue, the fact is they are the ones most responsible. God damn him. And I say that as an exhortation to Bill Keller's brutal deity. Sick, sick man. Preys upon the anguish and agonies of others in the name of Jesus Christ. He wrote further, he said, sadly, we deal with the loved ones of those who commit suicide every day. Suicide is a desperate and selfish act that is ultimately the sole responsibility of the person who made the choice to end their life. Everyone who commits suicide has reasons that led them to make such a horrible decision. The fact is, suicide is exponentially higher amongst those who choose the homosexual lifestyle. And while those in the media want to blame people like myself who take a biblical stand on this issue, the fact is they are the ones most responsible. A 15-year-old has no real understanding of sexuality, and most are still trying to figure out life and how they fit in. It is the homosexual community and media who promote this lifestyle to society, forcing it to validate legally and ethically this choice of sexual behavior and relationships to our children as normal, even desirable behavior. The Bible says in the last days the truth will become a lie, and a lie, and a lie the truth. You see, Keller is one of these snake oil drummers who peddles homo-nomo-therapy, just like Marcus Bachmann. Grinding his boot into the agonizing souls of the family of Jamie Hubley, he continues and concludes, it is the God in the Bible, not Bill Keller, that calls homosexuality a sin. It is sad to see children, those who don't even know what sex is, being brainwashed by our modern society that engaging in sex with a person of the same sex is a wonderful thing. God created sex between a man and a woman in the bonds of marriage. All sex outside of God's plan is not only a sin, but destructive. We're fortunate. to see God's grace. Daily working in the lives of men and women who have been in bondage to the lie of homosexuality as they find free freedom, true joy, and true peace, living as God created us. Hear and know the words of the demon followers of right-wing fundamentalist Christianity, wherein their Savior said not a word about gay people, and they most assuredly existed in the time of Yeshua, the brown-skinned Palestinian day laborer. Not a word. And Jesus did say unto them, woe to ye Homer sectionals, for I do not like thee. It ain't in there. Not a peep. Not a word. But they go clawing around through obscure passages tucked away somewhere behind thou shalt not wear a polyester dacron blend and decide that God said homosexuality is a sin. Many cultures have had taboos against homosexual conduct. Many others have not. Generally, you find those taboos against homosexuality where, A, it exists rather broadly, and, B, where there is a need for the tribe to grow and populate. Cultures may be rationally understood, you see, but religions never can. So that is where we will begin our prayer meeting Wednesday. A brief remark on the song I played. I don't think I'm going to play it anymore. I'm surprised I didn't get an email from anyone. I'm not going to play it anymore. And I did it deliberately so we could talk about this just a little bit. Now, there's going to be some mention of sport here, Horn family. Please don't go running screaming away from your computer speakers. He's talking about sports again. Because, once again, this is one of those moments where liberals and progressives' failure to understand that cultural phenomenon works to our detriment. Thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people go to NASCAR events, you see. And they don't just go to see drivers go fast around a track and turn left a lot. They go for the wrecks. And the same thing obtains in other the forms of racing as well. Our good buddy Spike could probably speak to this with more expertise than I. I am not a racing fan. But this past weekend, there was a horror in Las Vegas, Nevada. Two-time IndyCar champ Dan Weldon, a mere 33 years old, was killed this past Sunday in Las Vegas. In a 15-car IndyCar pileup at the Las Vegas Speedway, which had been promoted by the track and by the sponsor of the race, as being exceptionally dangerous and thrilling. The track itself was not conducive to running open-wheeled Indy cars on it. It had progressive grades in its banks. And if you ever see the footage, it's sickening to behold. It's amazing that only one individual died in that 15-car flameout. And the whole thing was pulled together as a stunt, a publicity stunt, with a $5 million purse to entice drivers onto that track. The track was overcrowded with cars. There were more cars on it than belonged there. And Dan Weldon, 33 years old, with two infant children and a lovely wife, was killed Pharaoh dead because the track was too fast, too small, and too crowded. Drivers had pointed it out. Journalists had pointed it out. Other race fans had pointed it out, as Dave Zirin notes in his column at The Nation. Before the Indy 500, drivers get an opportunity to practice for about 3 weeks. Drivers on this Vegas track had about, 3 hours of prep time. It was a recipe for disaster, and the disaster was fulfilled. At the height of empire, citizens and slaves, rich and poor, poured into the Circus Maximus and later the Flavian Amphitheater of Rome. We call it the Colosseum because of the giant statue of Nero that stood by at the Colosseo, to see mock naval battles, chariot races, gladiatorial combat, with everyone in the building knowing that they were going there not just to see the ordinary, but the spectacle of grim death itself. Something to remember, by the way, the next time you hear some ignorant Christian saying, "Well, the Christians were fed to the lions in the Colosseum," you can look at him and say, "I can't believe you, because it's obvious you know nothing about history. No Christians were fed to any lions in any Colosseum. The so-called persecutions took place in the Circus Maximus, on the backside of the Palatine Hill." Not in the Flavian Amphitheater. No. But they make that mistake all the time, because the members of that death cult are obsessed with gore and with grim, bloody death. Just a little history moment. So there you have it. No more boogity, 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 amen on Wednesday night prayer meeting. We'll go back to chaser, our old standard. But I wanted to explain, I wanted to just make mention of that horrible, horrible story and the price that people pay. For the greed of others. Because of that greed, two little children don't have a father, and a lovely young woman is without a spouse. There are greater costs in our world than we are inclined frequently to give the contemplation it deserves. 27, almost 26 minutes before the hour, and let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob. It's Janie.
Hey, Janie. How are you, dear?
Very good, thank you. How are you?
I'm well.
I'm sorry I missed you on October 6th.
Not half as sorry as I am. Because
it was amazing.
I was feeling sorry and being sorry at the same time.
It was phenomenal. I'm so glad that I went. It was the most incredible experience probably that I've ever had.
Well, I ran some of the video of Malloy's remarks, and they were profound and powerful, and I can't help but imagine the whole thing must have been that way.
I was in tears pretty much most of the day.
But they weren't tears of they weren't all tears of anger. Some of them were sort of uplifting, if that's possible.
Well, it's just cool to have be around like-minded people. And I did actually go to the Occupy Miami, and we had a phenomenal turnout. I couldn't believe. I mean, this is a cesspool of apathy, and I couldn't believe all of the people that actually showed up in Miami. And that was pretty cool, too.
Well, you know, so much of America, Janie, is a cesspool of apathy. But
true.
maybe some of that is wearing off. Maybe the lights are going on. Maybe realization is beginning to dawn because the difficulties are becoming more profound, are they not? It's getting harder and harder for ordinary people to get by.
Right. Yeah. And Miami is so much of a fake. You know, everything is all smoke and mirrors in this town. There's this up-and-coming area that used to be like a warehouse district. They call it the Arts District now, and they have, like, a lot of really cool restaurants and galleries and stuff. But I was reading an article in one of the local papers, and they park Ferraris out there. They rent the Ferraris. They hire, you know, attractive women. I mean, and I was just like, oh, my God. Wow. I didn't even think that people could do that.
That's amazing. Wow. Ferraris?
And Austin Martins, and, I mean, names of cars that I can't even pronounce, nor I knew existed.
Gee whiz.
So I was pretty impressed that all those people did actually turn out. And they do general assemblies every night at 6:30. And they were talking about going to one of the banks and withdrawing their money, and I wanted to go on one of those marches.
I would assume that would be Bank of America.
Well, you name it. Because Chase is all over down here like a virus.
Amazing, amazing. Bank of America is, I said Bank of America just because there is a move afoot to, I hope, punish Bank of America for its predatory practices and the fact that it doesn't pay taxes and still expects to have all the benefits and privileges of so-called personhood within the United States.
Are you familiar with that Occupy the Boardroom?
I've heard some about it, yes.
I emailed a Wells Fargo executive and asked if they were still, because I saw that they had a 21% increase in profit the last quarter. And they were foreclosing and repossessing troops' cars.
Yeah, I saw that too. That was way disgusting.
So I asked if they were continuing to do that.
Nice. I'm assuming there's been no response.
No. Well, apparently it's like it goes into like this big filter because they can't actually give out email addresses and all that stuff for privacy purposes. So it goes into this big filter, and the idea is to bombard all the major CEOs with emails.
Wow.
So I thought that was pretty cool.
It is.
And I loved your story about your trip. I didn't even know that that existed. I mean, that was really hopeful too.
Neither did I. And that's one of the benefits of me getting to get out of town every once in a while is the fact that, well, I think it's good for me because I need a change of perspective periodically just to remind me that there are other people in this struggle beyond the confines of the blasted mountains here.
Yeah.
And it is inspired.
It's grew up there.
And their dedication to saving their culture is incredibly inspiring. You're absolutely right. You were saying, I'm sorry.
That guy that you met that was actually from there, that was like total ironic.
Oh, it blew my mind because, you know, all I hear is, hey! And and unless I'm doing something wrong, there's really no reason for it. Hey! There's no reason for that. And then I looked at, oh, dang! What are you doing here? Fortunately, I didn't say, what are you doing here? I mean, but yeah, it was, it had the cachet of something that was supposed to be. And I know that sounds crazy coming from a non-religious person, but.
No, I think that, I mean, there's lots of things that happen like that, that doesn't mean that you are condoning a higher power or whatever. It's just nature. The way of the universe, you know. I think that things are meant to be.
Yeah, I think that's kind of where I was. Well, apart from going to D.C. and occupying Miami, and what's your world been? What have you been doing? You haven't been back to Haiti, I trust.
No, the organization that I went with, they're charging $300 to go there now. So I haven't been interested in going back. If a volunteer is a volunteer, you know.
Right.
I don't think you should have to pay to go to Haiti.
Well, I mean, you're paying for your own plane ticket, right?
Well, I think that's what... No, originally when I went, I didn't have to pay anything.
Oh, I see.
That was all... So I don't know if that's what that's about, but I get emails from them, and they're having tons of fundraisers with local celebrities from the Heat and all the teams and blah, blah, blah down here. And they're making tons of money, so I don't really know. I mean, the cost of living isn't that expensive in Haiti, but I don't really see how they can charge their volunteers to go there.
You think maybe some of the donations of necessary medical supplies might be drying up?
It's hard to say. I mean, you know, I mean, I don't know if you saw Sean Penn's interview when he was on Democracy Now, and he brought in narcotics and stuff, and he...
You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network. From the campus of the Irma Bird Center and Concord University's Beckley campus, welcome to another PRISM West Virginia American History Chat featuring your hosts, Keith Lilly and Dr. Bill O'Brien. Here's Dr. Bill and Professor Keith.
Thank you very much and welcome everyone to tonight's program. I want to welcome our enrolled teachers in our PRISM program, but I also want to welcome the folks that are tuned in through the Head On Radio Network. And Keith, I really think the more the more time we spend on planning and digesting the priorities of this program, the more we're realizing that the value that these folks outside the prison program bring to it is having a material impact on the program, the direction of the program, and I think on the quality of the program as well.
Certainly so.
You know, I really do. And we're kind of structuring these chats. Obviously, this evening, Heath and I both will want to spend some time. I'm going to spend a little bit of time, but Keith's going to spend much more talking about the development, the design, the development of the first assignments in each of the online courses. But at the same time, we want to focus our attention specifically on content itself. And I don't want those who are not enrolled teachers in the program, I don't want them to think for a second that their presence is not valued. And I'm hoping that we can use our time together this evening to convey some ideas and some insights and raise some questions. You know, it was interesting. On Tuesday mornings, I did this morning, I teach a class here in Beckley to senior citizens. And for lack of a better term, it's called the Life Enrichment class. I still have a little bit of life. I don't know how much enrichment is involved in it, but anyway, I've got a wonderful group of seniors that meets with me on Tuesday mornings, every Tuesday morning, over coffee and homemade pastry and bread and that kind of thing.
Oh, now we know what the
real deal is. Yeah, I was providing a service to senior citizens. That's that's the way I promoted the program. In actual fact, I'm up there eating homemade bread and pastries and various other things. But we were meeting this morning and we were just talking about the value of conversation. And more to the point, one of the people raised the issue and said, you know, sometimes the more time we spend together, the more I'm beginning to realize, she said, that the answers to some of these issues that we raise are pretty dull. It's raising the questions themselves that really stimulates the interest. That's really where the exciting and the interesting parts are. And I like to approach these chat sessions this time we have together on the Internet from the same perspective. The one piece of this that's missing, and Bob Kincaid mentioned this evening before he went on the air, that between now and the holidays, we're going to try to address this. We want to look at the viability of Skype accounts where we can get
interaction,
not only audio interaction, but also video interaction, where we can not only talk together, but we can actually see each other. And the technology is available, and the technology is there. Unfortunately, it's not quite taken hold in southern West Virginia yet, and that's the problem. We have some of our teachers that do have access to fairly sophisticated technology because of where they live. But so many of our folks don't. And so many of our students don't. And ultimately, it seems to me that if anything's going to happen in this part of the country in terms of economic development and career vision and creativity and all the rest of it, it's going to revolve around the development of at least bringing the technology that's already available to this area, let alone bring new technology as well. If I can, Keith, before you launch into this evening's the gist of this evening's program, I just want to make a couple of specific references to upcoming dates and due dates and those kinds of things, just to get them out of the way. I want to remind all the teachers, especially, that the first assignment for the essays in Unit 1 is due on the first Friday in December. I believe it's December 2nd. And the reason I say that is we will not be having another one of these chats until the 15th of November, just before we break for Thanksgiving. Actually, it'll be the, you know, like 8 days, 8 or 9 days before Thanksgiving. we will be having a chat. And then the next chat will be on the 29th of Thanksgiving, of November, which will be the Tuesday after Thanksgiving. And then the following Friday will be the due date for the PRISM, the Pillars of Principle course on the Founders, the first series of two essays. So I want to remind folks of that. Please don't let this slip. You don't want to get into a situation where you're trying to write these things at the last minute, because it's going to be slipshod, and it's just not going to, it's not going to basically reflect on the value of what you've already done in terms of the time you spend thinking about these issues, the documents you read, the issues you think about, reflect upon, and especially the time that you spend thinking about ways that you can utilize this in your classrooms. One of the teachers, Keith, that left us basically said in her email to me that one of the reasons that she was leaving is because after all the work on the founding, there was nothing on the founders on the West test. And I was kind of blown away by that comment, for a couple of reasons, and I won't get into that right now.
Something's wrong with the West test.
Something may be wrong with the West test. I mean, I think her assumption is that everything begins and ends with the West test. It may appear to be that way, but the fact of the matter is our education system is not performing the way we would like it to perform. The West test may be part and parcel of at least partially the reason for that. So in a sense, if you look at some of the key historians that we've had in here dealing with the founders, it's pretty obvious that they don't think that the founding is something that you can ignore, even if the West test does. So that kind of bothered me a little bit. The other thing is our whole point is to find a way to bring students to the West test from a totally different perspective than they used to, with the idea that even the West test itself begins to assume a little bit of credibility because it fits into something bigger. But be that as it may, the two things that I wanted to make folks aware of is that the first two essays in Unit 1 of the founding course, the Pillars of Principle, is due on the 2nd of December, which is a Friday. The second thing I wanted to make folks aware of is that our next scheduled chat will be on a Tuesday night. We'll send you emails to our enrolled teachers. It'll be on the 15th of November. So that gives us about 3 weeks or so, 3 or 4 weeks before we have another chat. I really am encouraging you to utilize that time in order to develop these essays, because as Keith's going to deal with this evening, you're going to have some things in the 19th century course that are going to be working simultaneously. So you don't want to get into a situation where you're letting one go for to the benefit of the other one and vice versa. Try to balance and plan your time in such a way that you can give due time and attention to each of these. I just wanted to take a moment to review a couple of things about the essays that you'll be writing. And the first thing I want to remind you of is, keep in mind last summer's presentation by Phil Roden on the DBQs. Phil gave us a pretty good rubric on the outline of a good essay. He talked about it from the perspective of how students write an essay and how we as teachers evaluate or grade that essay. But now you're writing essays as teachers. And what I want to do is emphasize the elements of a good essay as they were identified by Phil Roden. The idea that you make your points, the idea that you take your information and you tie it, you argue for your answer to the question by tying your sources to your answer to the question. In other words, you argue for your point of view. If you can remember the thrash-out sessions we had when we were talking about Valley Forge. So the first thing I want to emphasize is that your essay ought to be well organized and use Phil Roden's model. It's a good one. The second thing I want to emphasize is that your essay ought to include primary sources. Now, that doesn't mean it needs to include 100 primary sources. I would recommend that you don't want to do that. I would select, first of all, select your primary sources based on the question you're answering. Don't force the primary sources into the essay so that you can say you use primary sources. Instead, allow the question you're answering to dictate the sources you go to. For example, if you are dealing with the issue of rights and liberties, which I believe is the first question, then you want to deal with the Massachusetts Charter of Liberties, which we looked at during our last chat. You want to look at the structure of government and the whole issue of rights and where they come from. You want to look at Jefferson's effort in the Declaration of Independence to basically suggest that all men are created with certain unalienable rights and that these are rights that come from the Creator, from nature and nature's God. It's very important that you look at these as you look through the colonial period, look through the charters and the covenants that Bob Blist addressed in his presentation. So again, you want to use some primary sources. I'm not dictating or specifying a specific number, but you want to base your essay on primary sources because that is ultimately where your position on the question is best grounded. That's the first thing. The second thing is that you want to remember that this is a PRISM West Virginia history class and that you are teaching West Virginia youngsters. So the more you can use things that West Virginia youngsters are familiar with and comfortable with as a lead-in to those issues which they are not comfortable with, the better. In other words, I would suggest that as much as possible, you follow the direction of the grant in this sense. You try to use local history, West Virginia history, as a prism through which to look at the unfolding story on the national level. In other words, try to find or use West Virginia sources that your youngsters would be, your students would be comfortable with as what Phil Roden called a hook to the essay. In other words, the hook or the way that you introduce your subject by getting people interested in it by talking about something at the front end that they're familiar with. If you can do that, then chances are you'll be able to find ways that are much easier to use what you do in your classes. So again, you're looking to develop two of these essays. Concentrate on primary sources, but let your question dictate the primary sources that you use. If there seem to be primary sources that maybe you should have consulted and didn't, that's one of the comments I'll make when I read your essay. I'll try to make those recommendations and suggestions to you. So don't worry about that. This is the first set of essays. Just do the best job you can. Try to utilize everything we've talked about and things that we've done. And again, use what you can use in the classroom as best you can as a way to determine which questions you ought to be answering. And then depending on which questions those are, those should lead you directly to the key primary sources that probably ought to go into your essay, your answer. And the third thing, which is very obvious, I think everybody knows this, but I just want to say it anyway. If you are having any problems working on your questions, if you want to talk a little bit about your question, if you're having trouble getting started, email me, call me on the telephone. If I have to, I'll write the first sentence for you. You know, don't just get hung up I can remember times when I've been working on papers where I've sat there with my eyes up at the ceiling waiting for the first sentence of the first paragraph to drop down from the ceiling. It doesn't happen. It's not a drop-down menu like you see on a computer. So if you're having trouble, you don't know where to start, you don't know how to start, literally, I don't have a problem sitting down and going through your entire essay with you and asking you the kinds of questions which I hope will take you where you need to go. This is not an effort to pit me against you. This is not an effort to give me the opportunity to take the big red pen and criticize what you're doing. What we're trying to do is work together to not only become more familiar with the material, but to basically become more familiar with the skill of putting together an argument, collecting primary sources, arguing for our point of view, and coming up with an interpretive piece of history that we write, that we create, that really we can be proud of. And my role and Keith's role in all of this is to try to help you be successful in that, not in any way suggest ways that you are not successful. So please don't look at this in any way as a threatening experience, but rather as a learning experience. That's the way I look at it. I can't tell you what I learned from reading your essays, and I don't mean that to be facetious. It's true, because everybody who writes on this material tends to look at different things different ways, and it's very, very informative for me as well as for Keith. And I can use that in my future teaching. One of the members of the group emailed me a couple of days ago, and I answered him today. And he raised the question of geography, and he said one of the things that we should consider in a summer program is bringing a historical geographer in as one of the presenters, because he's beginning to realize that so much of history is determined by the geography, by where it happens.
That's an excellent point.
You know, and it's a great point.
That's an excellent point.
And I told him in my response to him today that I would do that, and I thanked him for the suggestion. That's what I'm talking about. You know, you all are, you are the people that know how to teach. So we've got the material here. We're asking you to apply your teaching skills to the content we have. The bargain is a good one. We learn more about teaching from you the content that we already have. You learn more of the content we have in efforts to try to fashion it into effective teaching for your students. And that's really what we're all about. So again, let me end this. Our next chat is on Tuesday, November 15th. It'll be 3 or 4 weeks from tonight. We'll send you an email reminding you of that. Your first assignment in the founding course, in the PRISM course, is due early in December, the 2nd of December, which is a Friday. Pick your questions, select your primary sources. If you want my help or my advice or suggestions or whatever, if you want Keith's here as well, we have the same phone number here. It's 256-0270, and then just, you know, I'm extension 2, and I think Keith is 2.
I'm extension 3.
He's extension 3. So, and if we're not here, just leave a voicemail. We'll call you back. We'll email you back. Anything we can do to make this a very positive experience for you, we will do.
Let me make one point real quick.
Okay.
In terms of email, it will operate, I think, much better if you email us individually through our Concord email addresses rather than through the PRISM Blackboard page.
Right.
Because I think then we'll know who we're dealing with and who's being emailed, et cetera.
When it comes through the Blackboard page, we can't reply.
No, we have to go over to the Blackboard page.
We have to go over, but we have to go out of the Blackboard page, look up your email address, and respond to you that way. And if we don't know who you are, we can't do that.
Right.
So, but if you send us an email, we can just hit reply and get right back to you.
Yeah, so that's going to expedite things if we do it
right,
that way.
Right. So anyway, if there are any questions or that anybody has, by all means, don't hesitate to contact us. Just don't let the December date go by and you haven't submitted, you haven't made contact with us, you haven't said anything. We don't know if there's something wrong with you or the assignment or whatever. Don't do that. If you're having trouble, let us know. Give us a chance to help you if you are having trouble. Because I think ultimately all of us will be successful in this, and hopefully it will be a positive experience for all of us. So with that, Keith, I'm going to kind of throw it to you, and you kind of you set the tone for the
I'll
rest of the evening,
it.
And we'll
okay.
we'll do the best we can to keep up.
Well, I think we should remind everybody about Gordon Wood's appearance in Charleston on Thursday the 27th, which is just two nights from tonight.
Two nights from tonight.
It's a 7:30, I believe, at the Cultural Center.
7:30 at the Cultural Center. There's plenty of parking.
Yeah, because I mean, you can park right where the Capitol's at.
Right.
The legislature's not in session, so that should not be a problem. The topic will be the revolutionary origins of the Civil War. So you want to talk about something that really fits what we're doing.
Yeah, that's exactly
so
what
well.
We're talking about, how the values and the principles and the ideals of the founders are revealed in the history that follows the founding.
And we are going to be there. We're going to go. And maybe next time when we get together for the next chat, we can maybe give a few minutes and talk about
talk about
what he says. Any of you want to come on out, I think that'd be great. I think that some Concord history students are going to attend. We're very much looking forward to that. Also, the research projects. I still do not have topics for everyone. And I don't want to assign topics by no stretch of the imagination. Some of you emailed me, and I've had to say, no, someone else has that topic. Go ahead and look through that list of suggested topics that I gave you during the summer. Make sure you get a topic, and the sooner you start working on that, the better, right? I want to encourage everyone to make sure they have a topic. I mean, again, the whole purpose for that particular part of the 19th century course is so that you have an opportunity to research something that you're interested in, something that will benefit you and your teaching. I mean, we want you to choose topics. We want you to choose essays in the units that are going to benefit you in your teaching. You know what you can use. You know what's best for you, and so we want you to do that. Part of this whole thing about the research projects is you're going to do that. You get something that's useful to you. You're going to produce a short work of history. We're going to put those things together. We're going to put them in a binder. We're going to put it in the Concord Library. Concord College or Concord University students for generations to come will be able to make use of your research. And so this is actually something I think to be excited about.
We are in the process of developing a website, and actually Bob Kincaid and his folks who are based, am I right, Bob, in Australia? John Fox in Australia. Is doing the legwork here, and we're beginning to put together a website, and eventually we're going to transpose all of what we have from Blackboard onto the website. Mm-hmm. So your proposal, your projects,
everything can be there.
The modules that you developed this summer, the videos of the presentations that we had this summer in the academy, these live chats, the archive copies of these, everything will be available on the website. Now, what that's going to mean is that not only you will have access to what's developed by other people in the program, but other teachers and other people outside will have access to this material and things that you've done as well. So we're hoping that we can ultimately create for you a permanent reservoir so that people will be able to go back to what you've done and what we've tried to do in this project for a long time to come, after some of us are long gone.
Yeah, we're expecting this to have a life.
Yeah.
A life of its own that goes beyond, obviously, the project itself. I changed the Unit 1 due date. I changed it, to November 15th, which was probably not the best choice.
That's okay.
But it's November 15th. I wanted everybody to have a little chance after this chat to work on it. It's been up since August, so I mean, it's been there, and so everyone's had a chance to already start working on it. But I did change the due date. I also had to make an alteration in terms of one of the web links for one of the documents. And, in fact, the document we'll probably allude to tonight was the George Canning to Richard Rush letter, August 20th, 1823. that website, which is bobsuniverse.com, no relation to our Bob, right? That website is down apparently, and so I have a new link, and I have that listed in the description underneath Unit 1, and I also have that as a web link right there on the Blackboard page. And so I want to make sure everyone had access to that document in case you didn't print it out or something of that nature. Then you have it. So I found it in another place. If you can find it in one place, you can find it in another
place.
Find it
in another place. So, George Canning is pretty prominent.
That's not that hard to
find. And I might tell you that this Bob's Universe is down, too.
Oh, sometimes. Sometimes. So there's a couple things I just kind of like, I guess you might say, maintenance-type things to think about in terms of what we're doing. Also, I will point out that on the Unit 1 question, when you look at the essay, it's 75 points, et cetera, but I have a list. I can't really show this to you, but you can see that teachers who are in our program can certainly see it. I have a kind of a checklist. It's so similar to what you were talking about. Argument, introduction, state your argument, conclusion that pulls all your basic points together, substantiation of your argument through primary sources, full citation of all evidence presented, good organization of grammar, and finally, how you might use your conclusions in your teaching. Yeah. And so those are things that I'm looking for in those essays that I'm hoping that you're going to include that was going to give you the most benefit from this. I mean, we want you to benefit from this. And so when you're looking at the 19th century, the first unit, choose the questions you think will benefit you the most in terms of your own teaching, something that you might actually do a unit on or something of that nature, and then go from there. I mean, I've given you all the documents. I mean, everything is document-based in Unit 1. So all the documents are there. From George Canning to the Monroe Doctrine, John Quincy Adams, Henry Clay, Andrew Jackson, Charles River Bridge case, all those things are there. But choose the question that you think you can benefit from, that you can make use of in your teaching. I mean, Bill, when I read, I try to read things that I think are going to be useful to me the next semester.
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
So what I'm reading now, I'm putting together a course on the Progressive Era. So what I'm reading now, I'm thinking about how it's going to benefit me down the line. So what you're doing with this, think about how it's going to benefit you, how you're going to be able to use it. We want you to be able to use these things. I mean, that's what this whole project's
and
about.
And that's part of the reason why you don't want to dictate a topic or anything like
right.
that to anybody.
And that's also why they're wide open. I mean,
yeah.
they're just... The questions are very wide open.
The issue here is the process of doing the of having the experience, not what you do. I mean, what you do is tied into what you can best use.
Right.
But you know, it's not that material to Keith or to me. What it is you do, we just want you to select something that's worthy of your time, and we'll have a payoff for you. And so that's really
right.
the.
And the last bit of housekeeping that I would have would be, again, we encourage any of you who are doing something in your class that you would like to share with your colleagues in the program and also with other people out there in the broader community and the broader world, we encourage you to come in and participate with us in these chats. And so, I mean, I think I mentioned that last time,
yeah.
but we would love for that opportunity to have
right.
some, one of you here telling us what you're doing, how you're using some of this material, how you're using some of these ideas in your classroom, we'd be thrilled
for
that to be the case.
One of the best things that happened this summer was when we had the Kindles and Patricia Siner put
yeah.
together her presentation and their handout on things you can do with a Kindle. I mean,
she knew more about it than I did.
She knew more about it than any
yeah,
of
that's
us
for sure.
did. And it was so valuable and so helpful, and it was a different voice. I mean, this is somebody from the group that came forward and said, hey, guys, this is what I've discovered. Look what you can do with this thing. You know, I mean, what a godsend that was, that presentation. If you have things like that that you'd like to bring to the attention of the other folks, we'd love to have you here with us on a Tuesday night. We'll feed you pizza.
Yeah, this is really, in a way, it's a pizza party.
It's
nice. So today you were at the Shepherd Center and you had homemade bread, and pastries.
My wife would die. She thinks I'm working.
Hopefully she doesn't have her computer, right?
She's working and she thinks I'm working. And she said, "Oh, I'm so glad you're back teaching that senior citizen class. I'm down there eating pastry and drinking coffee and visiting with people that I consider to be real friends." And this evening I'm kind of doing the same thing, but it's pizza tonight.
Different menu. Right?
We would really invite you to come and join us. Because we want to take an opportunity so that you can share the things that you've learned and that have worked for you with other folks. That's really what this is all about.
And you mentioned Patricia. She's an elementary teacher, and she's a really, really good one.
Yeah.
And I've been in her classroom.
She just absolutely oozes enthusiasm. There's no way in the world that a young kid could sit in her classroom and not get excited.
And they are excited. You can see it in their faces.
Yeah, and she is so excited.
And I'm convinced that I would have no shot. I would have no chance at survival in an elementary classroom. I don't know the first thing about how to teach elementary school, and don't even pretend to.
We've got 7 or 8 elementary teachers that we met this summer that are the best in the world. I mean, there's no way in the world we can tell them anything.
Right.
You know, and in fact, what we're hoping for is that we can provide an opportunity for you to tell us some of the things that have worked for you. But anyway, I think we're probably going to go into the 19th century a little bit this evening. And took me a while to believe that there really was one. I kind of thought that everything kind of ended with the War of 1812. I thought, you know, the Treaty of Ghent.
In there a little bit, right?
The end of the world. And
everything came to a close.
Everything after that was predicted by the founders, and that was the end of it. But Keith has pretty well convinced me that there are a few things that happen after the founding that are worth looking at, and that's kind of what where he's going to be taking us this evening. Again, if one thing on the overhead there, we have Margaret Ramsey. Margaret is sitting in at her computer. mramsey@concord.edu. If you have a comment or a question, then please feel free to email Margaret, and she will run in and hand the question or the comment to Bob, and we'll get it on the air for you as quickly as we can. So that's mramsey@concord.edu. Or if you want to call Margaret directly, it's area code 304-256-0270, and Margaret's extension is 229. When they ask for your extension, just type in 229, and you should get Margaret. She's sitting right at the desk.
Waiting with anticipation.
She's eating pizza, too. Don't worry about it.
She may even have a whole pizza down there. Who knows? So everybody remember that. I like to revisit the John Adams quote that's in the introduction to Unit 1, and it's from 1826. In fact, it's a month or so before John Adams passes away, and he writes this. And Bill, I believe John Adams, more than almost any of the founders, wrote with you and I in mind. Wrote with people who are going to study him in the future in mind.
Yeah, I think.
I think especially with his correspondence with Jefferson.
Yeah.
And to a degree, they both are writing for us.
Yeah.
As much as for each other.
Yeah, they're basically, as they move towards the end of their lives, they're obviously concerned with what future generations think of them.
Which is not surprising, right?
No.
I mean, every president since Harry Truman has established, of course, a presidential library upon leaving office.
Right.
And the whole idea
Though some of them didn't read all that much.
Right.
We won't go there.
But they've done that in order to make sure that they had a place to collect primary source material for favorable historians who will, of course, you know, write about them in the future.
And tell their story from their perspective. Exactly.
They think about that, and so John Adams and Thomas Jefferson were really no different in that sense. And so when Adams wrote this, he probably to a degree is thinking about us. But I really want to kind of point to the context here in terms of the year, 1826. His son, John Quincy Adams, is president. He was elected in 1824. Very controversial election, as we all know. And he wrote this. He said this: "My best wishes in the joys and the festivities and the solemn services of that day, on which will be completed the 50th year from its birth of the independence of the United States." He's talking about, you know, the 50th anniversary. Ironically, both he and Jefferson will die on July 4th, 1826. He's talking about the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. He describes it as a memorable epoch in the annals of the human race. And the idea, and Adams was certainly someone who forwarded this idea, the notion that the United States has a special place in human history, mm-hmm. a special place in the history of the world. I mean, in 1776, he wrote Abigail, and he told her to buy a folio book in order to save his letters, because he wanted it documented, the things that he was doing, the things that he was involved in. And so a memorable epoch in the annals of the human race, destined in future history to perform the brightest or the blackest page. The brightest or the blackest. So Adams contended in 1826 that the experiment that is the United States may end up being one of the brightest points in the history of the world, or it could end up being one of the blackest pages. It could end up being something that paves the way for horrendous events, which is kind of maybe how Adams would view the French Revolution, right? The French Revolution began as this moderate attempt to institute a limited constitutional monarchy, degenerated into this radical event, of course, killed the king and queen, and of course, the reign of terror and all those things that, you know, someone like Adams thought that kind of disorder was not a positive, to say the least. They disagreed, many of the framers, over that, according to the use or the abuse of those political institutions. So in other words, whether this is going to be a bright or a black page in human history, the experiment is the United States. Is going to depend on the use or the abuse of those political institutions by which they shall, in time to come, be shaped by the human mind. So he seems to understand, he does understand, that the creation of the founders was going to be interpreted and reinterpreted by subsequent generations. And the reality is, in 1826, that generation is there. His own son is president, and it's a different time. It's a different era. His generation is passing from the scene, and he realizes that another group will come along, will take that, and will take up the actual instruments, you know, the Constitution, etc., and interpret it for themselves. What they do with it was going to be very important.
You don't see the optimism that was reflected in Jefferson's quote that we put up a couple of weeks ago, where Jefferson believed that man's concern for his fellow man was embedded in his soul, and it just came naturally, and that man was basically good and basically considerate and whatever. The mere fact that Adams points to the fact that this could be the brightest page in history, but it also could be the blackest one, suggests that there are no guarantees here. And Jefferson, I believe that letter was 1816, maybe?
Yeah, it was much earlier.
Something like that. It was 10 years earlier. Jefferson was, you know, was arguing something much more positive. So to suggest that this could be the blackest page in the history of mankind was something that wouldn't have fit into Jefferson's thinking then at all. Now, of course, the question is, Has Jefferson always been consistent in that? And of course,
so, there's some questions. So there were changes taking place at this time.
Exactly.
That certainly were not necessarily seen as being completely positive. And that is, of course, in many ways, the value of this book, right? And of course, theirs is on Kindle, right?
Yes.
They have it on Kindle, but this is the actual hard copy. What hath God wrought? by Daniel Walker Howe, which we're kind of using as a textbook for the first part of the 19th century course. It's part of the Oxford University History of the United States.
Great series.
And, you know, you want to talk about books that local libraries could use or that high school libraries could use. It would be books like this, Gordon Wood's Empire of Liberty, George Herring's From Colony to Superpower. I think David Kennedy even has a volume that makes this one look kind of slight on the Great Depression and World War II. The United States and the Great Depression.
But, you know, these Oxford series, these are textbooks in a sense, but they really are so elaborate, there's so much information and so much depth in them, that for the teacher, they provide the kind of background and context that it would seem to me
right.
would be, you wouldn't really wouldn't ever have to go much further than that.
Right? They're very useful. Extremely useful.
Yeah.
And every volume is written by a tested, tried and true historian, someone who really, you know, is well regarded in the field, has been there for some time. Gordon Wood's a great example of this. And so the same is true here. And in fact, Howe deals with all different aspects from 1815 to 1848. He deals with politics. He deals with military histories in there, diplomatic history. It's all there. Social history, religious history,
women's history.
Yes, it's all there.
Reform.
Yeah.
And so it's very interesting because I've been talking with Keith about I have Howe's book on my Kindle as well, and I'm having and maybe this is in part my age, I'm having trouble dealing with getting used to the transition from traditional books to Kindle.
Yeah.
I really am. And but one of the things I've picked up in reading Howe's book, because it's monumental, it's a monumental book. It's 900 and some odd pages.
Yeah.
But the way the book is divided, depending on what you know about the period, and again, I refer you to having a good textbook at hand. Well, you can kind of get a broad overview of the entire period and then look at this thing. And what you find is that he's got multi-pages on the issues which the textbook may only have a short paragraph or just a couple of sentences about. And so women's history and reform and church history and the second Great Awakening and economic reform and foreign policy and all of these. So it very quickly, as you go through Howe, you can begin to see what that section's about. And depending on whether, in fact, that particular subject is going to fit into your overall framework as a teacher or as putting together a question for this course or whatever, you can spend as much time or as little time as you need to once you realize what the particular section of the book is. Once you begin to realize that, you can move through this book much more rapidly than you would think.
Right. And I think it's fairly readable myself. But I kind of want to point to a few things he's doing here. And this is something that, you know, if you read into the book any at all, you've seen this. Howe disagrees with some of the ways that the period from 1815 to 1848, those are two very traditional dates to begin and end. I like that, right? The Congress of Vienna, of course, 1848 is an election year, but also the revolutions in Europe.
Yeah.
But he disagrees with some of the standard interpretations. He does not like the term, for example, Jacksonian democracy. He points out that, you know, how many people are left out, which is true. And in fact, one of the things about the early 19th century, the so-called Jacksonian period, is the movement toward dropping property qualifications and, of course, adopting universal white manhood suffrage. When the word white is entered into the law, for example, in the state of Pennsylvania, that meant free blacks then were excluded from suffrage. And so, yes, the electorate was increased, but there certainly were significant elements that, of course, are excluded. And he makes that point, and there's nothing wrong, I think, with making that point. He also disagrees to a degree with the often touted interpretation of the market revolution, right? The idea that we're moving more and more toward manufacturing. Yes, there's something to that, he would contend, but he definitely wants to remind us that America was still very much largely agrarian. And he has a statistic here on page 36 that points out that, you know, two-thirds of the cloth was still made at home. And so only a third of the cloth being made in America was actually manufactured. Two-thirds is made at home. People are making their own clothes, right? That's very different, you know, obviously from the society that we live in.
Right.
But he uses some census material from 1810. And he's talking about the nature demographically of American society. And this is actually on page 37, but on the Kindle, I realize that doesn't really count for much. But he says it was a young society, quoting him here. The census listed the median age as 16 and only one person in eight as over 43 years old. He goes on to say, women bore children in agony and danger, making their life expectancy, unlike today, slightly shorter than that of men. Once born, infants often succumbed to diseases like diphtheria, scarlet fever, and whooping cough. One-third of white children, over half of black children, died before reaching adulthood. So those are actually some stunning statistics, in a sense. But he emphasizes, for example, that this was a young society. The median age was 16. That's the census of 1810. The census of 2010 would tell us that today the median age is 35.3. And so we're a much, much older society than 1810 America. But think about that. If the median age is 16 and only one in eight are over 43, Andrew Jackson and John Quincy Adams were 43 years old in 1810. The societies, and they are considerably older than the median, right? They're the leaders of the next generation, and they're considerably older than the median. But, you know, you think about that next generation of leaders. For example, I have a couple here. Calhoun and Webster were both 28. So they were born in 1782. Clay was 33. Right? He was born in 1777. So these were people who really had very little personal experience, if any at all, with the era of the Revolution and the Founding.
Right.
John Quincy Adams did, right? I will concede that his father, one of the founders, he was not a founder. We went into that. He was not, but his father was. He was with his father in Europe. I mean, he did know Franklin. He did know Jefferson. He knew these people. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, that next generation of leaders, they really had no personal contact, for the most part, with the American Revolution. Jackson, slightly, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so they really are, in every sense, a new generation.
John Kaminsky, it was Stanley Cutler made the point when he was with us that John Marshall, he referred to John Marshall as one of the founders, but he was kind of a transient, he kind of had a foot in each camp, more or less, because he stays, he becomes Chief Justice and is Chief Justice until he dies in 1837, when Taney becomes Chief Justice. And, but you're right. And of course, then the question is, you've got the ideals and the values and the principles of the founders, that even though these people didn't know the people, they knew the ideas. The question is whether they got the ideas in the same form that they were originally.
How were they going to interpret them, and how did they view the United States?
And how did they look at these values and principles in a United States that was changing?
Yeah.
And it was confronting a whole different set of problems than the original founders ever could have imagined.
Yeah, and Howe points those things out. I mean, things such as, he talks about the communication revolution. I mean, the very title of the book is obviously connected with Morse and the telegraph system. So, you know, telegraphs and eventually railroads and all those things, it is a revolutionary period. We can kind of understand it, I think.
Yeah.
If we think about our own lifetime and the type of technological changes taking place, you know, even in the past 20 years, I mean, it's phenomenal, the rate of change has taken place. And so it's a very changing world, we're a changing society, and a different generation is coming to the forefront. How are they going to interpret those principles? What do they feel is the United States' place in the world? Is, I guess, what we're getting at. We have a question?
Well, it's a comment, but it's a suggestion that I think is very relevant, and I wanted to share it if we can.
Okay, go ahead.
This is an email from a listener, a longtime listener of Bob's on the Head On Network. She is a school teacher in Texas that is currently unemployed. This is Rick Perry's Texas, but we won't go there. She does, but we won't go there. But anyway, she has some suggestions from her experience that might benefit all of us, and I think it's worth hearing. She said, the district where I taught for 12 years has teachers organize curriculum units under two headings, questions of significance, and then in parentheses, that we want students, questions of significance that we want students to ask and to consider and possibly debate. And the second heading is enduring understandings, facts, dates, skills, must then fit into one of those two categories. And she says a very useful model for deciding how to cover history, what to consider, and what we want students to do with the information that we present. What are the central questions? What understandings do we want students to come away with at the end of the course? Then, of course, is the question of what's on the standardized test. But it sounds like that plagues West Virginia teachers, too. She's obviously referring to my comment earlier about
the West test.
The teacher who left us in the West test. So here's something from Texas. I mean, this is the value of technology, folks, because you get this right now. You don't have to get, you don't get it in a letter, in snail mail, or anything else. So here we are talking about this, and here's a teacher from the other side of the country, so to speak, that's basically telling us the way they organize the thing into two questions. What are the understandings we want students to leave with, and what are the questions that we feel are the most relevant to be raised? What do we want youngsters to come away with at the end of a course or at the end of a unit or at the end of a topic? And then, of course, you have the standardized test. And so, theoretically, at some point in time, we have to believe that the standardized tests will actually accurately reflect much more precisely what it is that we want youngsters to master. The test theoretically ought to be a reflection of what people know, not the end result of what people should know, and that's really the issue here.
And that something is problematic in terms of most standardized tests are, I believe, multiple choice.
Yeah.
And well, you know how I feel about multiple choice, and on the college level, I really think it has no place at all. And an essay, and that's the reason why all this stuff is essay-based. An essay gives someone a chance to tell you what they know.
Right.
Something that's something like multiple choice, it's either right or it's wrong. I mean, there's no getting around it.
The multiple choice test or the short answer test. First of all, you dictate what the question's about, but more important, you phrase the question in such a way, in order to distinguish so that everybody doesn't get it right, you have to phrase the question in such a way that half your people don't understand it. You know, and that's what you want, is to separate the people who read well from those who don't. So in a sense,
so you put three answers that sound right.
Yeah. Exactly.
One answers it best.
And the right. Less sophisticated learner is going to fall for what seems to be obvious. And your brightest student is not. And that's what you want. So in reality, you're penalizing your weaker students. And the irony is they feel much more comfortable with it, when in fact they'd be much better off with the essay test because they control basically what ultimately comes out. When they're explaining what they know, they're in control. But anyway, we got off a little bit.
Well, that's all I know. I think it's a good comment, and I certainly appreciate it.
I want to thank the person who sent this. This is very helpful.
Excellent. So it's a changing world, a changing nation at this particular time. One of the questions I have on the unit, I'm not going to go through each one of them, but one of my thought was really appealing to me was the one about the Monroe Doctrine. And the document that I had on here on the 19th century material actually was George Canning's letter to Richard Rush, who was a U.S. minister to Great Britain. Canning in the letter is, of course, suggesting that the United States and Great Britain cooperate, considering some of the aspirations of the European powers. This eventually, of course, leads to the Monroe Doctrine. But, of course, Monroe, as president, presided over what is often thought of as the era of good feelings, something that, of course, Howe very much questions, whether that actually is true or not. The idea that they're really... that Monroe's presenting the idea that there really was no faction or party, that essentially the War of 1812 had effectively destroyed the Federalists as an...
kind of like when the Federalist Party went under for all practical purposes.
Right.
So the fact that everybody's a Republican suggests that everybody is in agreement on key issues. And Howe points out that that's the furthest from the truth.
Yeah,
and it's kind of like when the Soviet Union fell in 89. People believed that the Cold War was over, and we were in for the beginning of the 21st century. We were in for a world where there wasn't a Cold War, and there wasn't the factionalism and the distrust between superpowers that had dominated the world since the end of World War II. Well, in effect, what we see, and we continue to see in Afghanistan and Iraq and Iran and everywhere else, Libya and everywhere else, is the fact that there's a lot of discord, a lot of factionalism, a lot of distrust going on within what appears to be a world that is free of the threat of international communism. That didn't mean that all the problems went away.
No, even if you don't have those distinct ideological differences. That certainly, I think Howe makes a great point there, in a sense. I mean, 1824, every candidate that ran claimed to be a Democratic Republican.
Yeah.
But John Quincy Adams and Henry Clay have a lot of Federalists in them. They have a lot of positions that are very similar to Hamilton's positions. One of the questions for Unit 1 is if you look at John Quincy Adams, how would you tie him with the framers? As his presidency,
right?
That's certainly, it's certainly I think a question that you can answer by looking at his policies, right? Mm-hmm. And by looking at that first annual address, which is the document I have. The idea there is that you have an air of good feelings. That's certainly not the case. I guess you might say the debate in the 1820s was. Really, what was the place of the United States in the world? What was the role of the United States in the world? John Adams was talking about, essentially in 1826, what the United States meant in terms of human history. Mm-hmm. And what would it mean? And that was yet to be determined.
Right.
Where was the United States' place? And so we have a couple documents, I think, that might help us out here. Ironically, one will be, of course, John Quincy Adams. And this is a warning against the search for monsters to destroy in 1821. This is John Quincy Adams, I think, is useful for people, if for nothing else, building vocabulary. His erudition is undeniable. His intelligence is, incredible. And the words he uses, the phrases he uses, the intellect that he had comes out in everything he wrote.
John and Abigail raised him to be president. I mean,
yes.
There's no question. And so you might say that John Quincy Adams is kind of a direct link back to the original founders.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact of the matter is that implies that John Adams was in sync with the rest of the founders. And there's some question as to whether that's true
that's
or not.
Yeah.
John Adams, when he became president in 96, he had an awful time. I mean, he had an awful time. And people laughed at him and scoffed at him and belittled him and everything else because he was considered to be so out of touch with the country, with people. And so, in reality, to say that John Adams is a direct link from the founders to his son John Quincy, and that's a direct link is debatable.
Is debatable. Of course, there is a little bit of an irony there in the sense that John Quincy Adams, his presidency will be very troubled as well, but maybe for slightly different reasons. It's obvious the fact that, you know, that Jackson feels he's been cheated out of the election because of a deal between Adams and Clay. That's given the election, which was in the House of Representatives, thrown to the House of Representatives, to Adams. I mean, Clay becomes Secretary of State. And of course, Jackson's supporters, you know, proclaim that that is a corrupt bargain, that there's been a backroom deal, and that Jackson's been deprived of the presidency. And they campaigned from him. They campaigned for Jackson and against John Quincy Adams from day one. But this document looks back to when John Quincy Adams was Secretary of State for James Monroe. Arguably, John Quincy Adams is one of the greatest Secretaries of State of all of American history. And he's saying some interesting things here about the United States and its place in the world, its role in the world, in world affairs. And he opens the document, and if we look at this and kind of take it apart a little bit, he says, "And now, friends and countrymen, if the wise and learned philosophers of the elder world, the first observers of nutation and aberration, the discoverers of maddening ether and invisible planets, the inventors of concrete rockets and shrapnel shells, should find their hearts disposed to inquire what has America done for the benefit of mankind." That's a question. It's an incredibly fancy way of saying, if Europe was to ask, you know, the elder world,
what has America contributed to the best interests of the world?
Some of the things that that Europe's contributed is good, I guess, but he also mentions weaponry and the concrete rockets, which of course had been invented in, I think, in 1806. It's a very I guess you might say a grandiose way of asking this question. Very colorful. You know, what really has the United States done?
Benefit of mankind.
For the benefit of mankind. Now, Europe's done things, and Europe has, you know, and we have to remember one thing, especially in the last, not this next year, but after that, we will have, of course, an academy, and then obviously a course on American foreign relations. When I took a graduate seminar on diplomatic history, American diplomatic history, and I'm sure you probably took one at one time as well. But when I took a graduate seminar on American diplomatic history, and the one who taught it was actually the chair of my thesis committee, Ronald Nurse, Professor Nurse at Virginia Tech, the course started in 1890. In other words, we kind of summarized everything that happened up to 1890. I remember he also had an undergraduate course because I was his teaching assistant. I was his graduate assistant. I graded his papers. And so I would go to those lectures sometimes. Everything that happened before 1890 was largely, you know, just kind of background material. If you look at William Appleman Williams' classic, you know, Tragedy of American Diplomacy, it really starts, you know, in the late 19th century. In other words, there's a kind of a tendency to ignore the United States as a weak provincial power
it becomes a world power. It's insignificant.
It becomes a world power, and so maybe there's a little sensitivity. The idea that Europe is filled with great powers, with Great Britain, the great naval power, with France, you know, with great land power, you know, with emerging powers like Prussia and Russia,
etc. Just one comment, which is a little bit, it's related to this, but I don't want to get you off on a tangent. if you look at the way West Virginia teaches American history, you have American history taught in grades 4 and 5, maybe?
I'm not really sure.
There's no American history taught again until grade 9. And then America is taught in grade 11, but it's taught as world history. It's taught about America and the modern world. And so in reality, the way we teach American history in West Virginia to youngsters is pretty much modeled on the foreign policy priorities that you that you experience.
Yeah.
In other words, their assumption is that what happened prior to the 20th century, at least in foreign policy, is not really significant.
Right.
In other words, it's only when America's impact is directly seen on the rest of the world that American foreign policy seems to be something worth studying. It's scary.
And that's faulty. Well, I mean, it's somewhat scary anyway because, you know, diplomatic history, in a way, in terms of the field of history, is somewhat under assault.
Yeah.
I mean, you're not finding it in major universities. Diplomatic historians who are retiring are not being replaced by other diplomatic historians. It's not the, and part of that is diplomatic history is seen as elitist history because foreign policy generally is conducted by elites, right? And so that's part of it. That, very unfortunate. And so a lot of the best stuff in terms of foreign policy is actually being written by journalists or former diplomats. I mean, remember Zimmerman? I think his name. He wrote the book
Zimmerman
about
Zimmerman.
Not the Zimmerman telegram. I think he was an American diplomat who he wrote a book on the relationship between Theodore Roosevelt and Henry Adams and Henry Cabot Lodge and John Hay and all those. I can't remember the name of the book.
It's
The Great Triumphant or something
like that. Recently, yeah.
Yes, I think he died here recently.
Right.
Evan Thomas.
I've got the book.
Evan Thomas, The War Lovers, is a very recent book about kind of a similar topic.
Right.
How the relationship between these prominent people actually turned into a particular policy.
Right.
United States going to war with Spain in 1898. But very often these are not academic historians. Academic historians write too much for each other.
Right.
And not enough for, you know, the public at large. Diplomatic history, very important. Foreign policy history is vital. It's vital to our history. But it is kind of odd in a sense that there's so much of a tendency not to look at it until the United States becomes a world power, when in many ways, if we kind of go back a little bit into your period, in a sense we're born out of diplomacy. Franklin's mission in France is not something that is of no significance in terms of the outcome of the Revolutionary War.
Foreign policy considerations are directly responsible for American independence in many ways.
We are born out of international relations. In fact, one book that, again, I mentioned a while ago as part of that series at Oxford University series on the history of the United States, George Herring, From Colony to Superpower, he makes that point. I mean, we're always have been involved in international relations. That's always been the case. He also makes the point, it's kind of interesting, that we often claim to be peaceful and peace-loving, but somehow or another, every generation's had its own war.
Yeah, that's right.
Every generation's had its own war. And that's something that's so simple. That's something that's so obvious. All you have to do is kind of go down and look through it, look through a general survey of American history, but something that very often, you know, you're not going to find that in a regular general textbook. You know that, this idea that, you know, yes, that we say that, but sometimes we are something else. Here, I think John Quincy is saying, you know, what does the United States contribute to the world? And he gives us an answer.
This is where I was going. Go ahead.
Okay, no, he gives us an answer. He says, let our answer be this. This is going to be our answer. He says, America, with the same voice which spoke herself into existence as a nation, you want to talk about terminology, loaded terminology, spoke herself into existence
as a nation.
As a like a God in the Bible in the Old Testament speaks the universe into existence. Let there be light.
Yep.
You know, we said, let there be independence. France might have something to say about that. But proclaim to mankind the inextinguishable rights of human nature and the only lawful foundations of government. America and the Assembly of Nations, since their admission among them, is invariably, though often fruitlessly, held forth to them the hand of honest friendship, of equal freedom, of generous reciprocity. Generous reciprocity. So America, in essence, has this role, I think he's identifying, right?
Yes.
We proclaimed inextinguishable rights of humanity, the only foundations, lawful foundations of government. What we're kind of thinking about is what the United States, what's its place as far as it's concerned, and its leadership's concerned in this case, in light of the world. And what I was thinking about when I was reading that earlier, I was kind of going over these things again, I was thinking, you know, Europeans would view that very differently, especially in, let's say, Prussia, or an absolutist state. Many of the nations of Europe, and even to some degree even Britain, even though so many of our institutions and our political ideas are really English in origin, even in Britain, to a degree, the United States is an example of something they hope does not succeed. Mm-hmm. Because, in essence, it is the beacon of liberalism. Mm-hmm. And so Adams is saying, you know, we're the beacon of liberalism. We are liberalism. We're the example to the rest of the world of what this is, right? What real government which has a lawful foundation.
You know,
is.
In the introduction, the historical introduction to the summer program, I think it was,
mm-hmm.
One of the things I tried to point out in the essay there was that in many ways the Treaty of Ghent and the end of the War of 1812 was an effort to try to restore Europe to the world before the American Revolution.
Right.
Because ultimately, the ideas of the founders basically gave rise to Napoleon.
Right.
In many ways.
Exactly.
And Napoleon basically spread these ideas all over Europe, and created a problem. And the leaders of the countries of Europe in 1815 are trying to put it all back in a bottle again.
Yeah. And Europeans understood that.
Yeah.
Europeans understood that. They understood that the American Revolution is the predecessor to the French Revolution.
Yeah.
They were very much aware of that, and that it is a model in some ways for at least that early phase of the French Revolution. But something happened with the French Revolution, and it became radical, obviously, and then reactionary. And Napoleon defines a revolution.
And the revolutions of 1848 in Europe, are an extension of
right.
this whole thing with the emergence of the so-called common people in the person of Andrew Jackson and all the rest of it. I mean, it's basically a kind of a continuum, and it was really it all started here. So in reality, what John Quincy Adams is saying right here, what has America contributed to the world, to the benefit of mankind? His answer, our answer, is that America is the first nation in the history of the world, the first people in the world, to basically declare the inextinguishable rights of human nature and the legitimate foundations of government being based on the sovereignty of the people, the consent of the governed, and all of this. So in reality, what he's basically suggesting here in a context of foreign policy is that America's role in foreign policy is potentially
to promote this
around the world, exactly.
At least by example.
Yeah.
At least by, and that's not a new idea. That's an idea that goes
all the way back to John Winthrop.
You can go back to Winthrop, the city on the hill, that we're going to be the example. So he certainly has that.
But when George Bush said, when asked about by the press about why in 2003 in March about why we went into Iraq and overthrew Saddam, and his response was, one of our goals is to create a democracy in the middle of the Middle East.
Yeah. Or you go back before that, you go to Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson says we're going
right.
to get into the world, make the world safer democracy.
So this is what was, and we're seeing all of this unfold. So they're taking the ideas of the founders and what the American independence movement was about, and they're basically turning it into a statement of mission.
Yeah. And you take it back before Wilson, you take it to Lincoln, and Lincoln says, you know, in one of his addresses, one of his annual addresses to Congress, that that the United States, a union, during the midst of the Civil War, the union is the last best hope of Earth.
Right.
The last best hope of Earth. And something, if you look at the material that Kevin Chanley brought with him on Civil War diplomacy, one of the things is the Europeans understood this. I mean, some of them understood it and applauded it. And liberals in Europe understood it and applauded it. Conservatives understood it and hoped the Confederacy would win.
Yeah.
And so that they viewed that through an ideological spectrum. The same is even true back here in the 1820s. I mean, yet Napoleon unleashed everything, right? Napoleon paid lip service to the concepts of liberalism, but it really had a very authoritarian regime.
Right.
I mean, I think you could vote for notables.
Right.
People who could be selected to
right.
be
an army
officials.
An army right. that is yeah. marching to spread freedom.
Right, right, yeah. So, I mean, there's a lot of inconsistency. In fact, that comes up again here. But Napoleon also altered the map and made it impossible to put Humpty Dumpty back together again. And so what the victorious powers did at Congress of Vienna is they tried to restructure the world. And this is vital in terms of really understanding what happens here. They tried to restructure the world really along two principles. And the Congress of Vienna, they agree on what they're trying to accomplish. They might disagree on particulars, but they agree on the basic principles of what international relations should be. It's so unlike the Paris Peace Conference, where they don't agree.
Yeah.
Right? But in the Congress of Vienna, they understand it needs to be legitimacy or the restoration of proper dynasties. So wherever possible, Napoleon had tried to overthrow, for example, the Bourbon dynasty in Spain, install a brother, his brother Joseph as king. He had overthrown the Bourbons in Naples and put his brother-in-law and sister on the throne. Wherever possible, they're going to take those people off the throne, put the right families back on, and balance of power. They're going to try to, you know, without any reference to self-determination whatsoever, you know, if Prussia gets this part of Poland, then Russia must have that part of Poland. You know, and make sure that no one gets too much territorial aggrandizement as a result. But also, Metternich and his colleagues wanted to find a way to prevent other revolutions from taking place. And that's, of course, the whole Congress system, the Metternich system, the Holy Alliance, as it's called. And the whole idea of the Holy Alliance is Austria, Prussia, and Russia agree that they are going to join together militarily to put down any future revolutions. The question is, eventually they want to apply that to the New World. And with a restored Spain, a restored Portugal, there have been all these revolutions, obviously, in Latin America. All these things are the result of the American Revolution, right? The American Revolution is the first example of a colonial peoples securing their independence from a European power, but not the last, right? Not the last by any stretch of the imagination. All those new republics in Latin America and South America, the Congress system, Europe, many of the powers of Europe, not Britain, but many of the powers of Europe, want to restore imperial control of those places. How is the United States going to react? This is a big threat, a big challenge to the United States and how the United States views its role, especially on this side of the ocean. So a lot of what we're thinking about in terms of this document and even in terms of the Monroe Doctrine question, you kind of have to kind of think about that a little bit. And that's just good background. And of course, the way I phrase the question, I have them looking for background, right? You're wanting to find that. You're wanting to kind of get in that a little bit. And any textbook, all kinds of information on the Holy Alliance. But he's saying, you know, we're the ones who afford this idea of liberalism. People should have voice in government. He's talking about what we've done. She's uniformly spoken among them, though often to heedless and often disdainful ears, the language of equal liberty, of equal justice, and equal rights. She has, in the lapse of nearly half a century, without a single exception, respected the independence of other nations while asserting and maintaining her own. She has abstained from interference in the concerns of others, even when conflict has been a principle to which she clings, as to the last vital drop that visits the heart. There is the kind of the idea that the United States has a long isolationist tradition, which is something we can certainly debate about. Mm-hmm. I think it's questionable. Yeah. I think it's very questionable. But at least as an ideal, and John Adams, John Quincy Adams' father, of course, in 1776, presented to Continental Congress a model treaty for any possible treaties or alliances we may have with other nations, France. And the basic thrust of that treaty, and by the way, Franklin ignored it altogether, was that we would not become involved in an entangling alliance. I mean, this is before Washington's farewell address.
Right.
But that's the language, right? That's the language. And so you see a lot of the documents at this time talking about that. We've got to make sure we don't get wrapped up in Europe's problems, right? Europe's going to have wars. In fact, he says that. I mean, look what he says here. He says, she has seen that probably for centuries to come, all the contests of that Alcedema, the European world, Alcedema, that's a biblical reference to the potter's field that's purchased by the Pharisees with the money that the traitor Judas gives back. So it's kind of a word used to describe any distasteful or horrible place. So he's saying right. that about Europe. He spent a lot of time in Europe. I mean,
right.
He was minister to Prussia, minister to the Dutch. He spent time in St. Petersburg, Tsarist Russia. You know, the European world would be contests of inveterate power and emerging right. They're going to always be at war. They're going to always be fighting. There's always going to be problems in Europe.
Right.
Wherever the standard of freedom and independence has been or shall be unfurled, there will her heart, the United States heart,
right.
her benedictions, her prayers be. We are going to always support people. We're
always going to support the right.
Free
the
and independent.
Forces of right.
Right.
And look at the debate we've been in the last couple of weeks about Libya and about Gaddafi.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And whether the critics of President Obama are saying we should have been more forceful in our support of the reform governments in their efforts to overthrow Gaddafi, and others say we should have been much more adamant in our position against revolutionaries.
And so, yeah.
So the question is, which side do you take, you know? And so what you hope is that the people who win set up a government that we can be comfortable with. And that way it would make everything that we did or didn't do okay.
And in that instance, that's what is so frightening. What will fill the vacuum?
Right.
We simply don't know.
Right, right.
We simply don't know. And will it be something that's favorable? Will it be something that's not?
So you're saying, I mean, I'm not going to put words in Gordon Wood's mouth on Thursday night.
Okay.
But my suspicion is that one of the things he's going to say about the connections between the founding and the Civil War is that the ideas of the founders which justified independence become kind of the dominant message of America to the world from that point on. And the debate over the union that's going to happen in the 19th century between North and South is going to revolve an awful lot around what the founders talked about.
And that's certainly the way Lincoln presented it. And who really made that case, I think, so well, again, last summer, was Carson Holloway.
Right.
He made that case. He made that point. And again, look at that. I think it's the first annual address at Lincoln.
Right.
That Lincoln to Congress, and he talks about the United States being the last best hope for all the households.
But all of our teachers have a list of the documents that Carson Holloway referred to, all the speeches of Lincoln
right. And
the letters of Lincoln in which he made references to these things. And what Lincoln is doing is going back to the founders to justify his positions in the 19th century.
The irony is Jefferson Davis is doing the same thing.
He's doing the same thing in the Confederacy.
What they use and how they use it, which is kind of like what Adams was talking about. I mean, the idea that what we have done is really, in a sense, up for interpretation. But, of course, it shouldn't be too surprising. I don't believe they actually agreed either. I mean, Jefferson and Hamilton do not agree on what the Constitution means. And so, you know, how can you expect that the framers cannot agree? Jefferson, I know, was not at the Constitutional Convention. If the framers did not agree, it shouldn't be surprising that subsequent generations would not agree either. And so, yeah, but I mean, he goes on, you know, but she goes not abroad in search of monsters to destroy. She is the well-wisher of the freedom and independence of all. I mean, we're well-wishers, which he says she is the champion and vindicator only of her own right.
So right? this idea that's becoming so important in the election that's coming here in this country is what we call American exceptionalism. The idea is that America is different than every other country in the world because what we're about and what our foreign policy is based on is a selfless foreign policy, which basically is designed to promote the ideas of freedom and equality and popular sovereignty and all the elements of our own independence movement. And that's what we're about. It's the most unselfish foreign policy of any nation in the world. And you can hear people who go all the way back to Vietnam, the people who felt we should be in Iraq, we shouldn't be in Iraq. The debate revolves around, do we have a right to be in there? Do we have a right to impose our will on other people?
Right.
And the answer is, you have a right to impose it if what your will is for their own best interests.
Right. And you had the same debate in the 1890s over intervention in Cuba against
right.
Spain. So, I mean,
right.
the same thing over and over again. There's some consistent threads. I will point out, John Quincy Adams says, you know, we're going to support, you know, these principles, but we're not looking for any monsters to destroy.
Right.
We're militarily weak.
Right.
And so we're not going to look for any monsters to destroy.
We just stand for what's right.
We stand for what's right, but we don't have the, you know, and the difference between John Quincy Adams and Theodore Russell.
He's his father's son, isn't he?
Yeah.
He's his
right.
father's son.
He says she is the champion and vindicator only of her own, right? Only of her own right. She will commend the general cause by the countenance of her voice and the benignant sympathy of her example. She well knows that by once enlisting under others' banner, this is kind of interesting here. She well knows that by once enlisting under other banners than her own, were they even the banners of foreign independence, she would involve herself beyond the power of extrication, getting into a quagmire, in all the wars of interest and intrigue, of individual avarice, envy, and ambition, which assume the colors and usurp the standard of freedom. Napoleon claimed to be about the rights of the father, the rights of the French, right?
Yeah.
But Napoleon was about his own power,
right.
the aggrandizement of his own state, his own legacy, all those things. And so we know that the Europeans are always going to be involved in warfare. They're always going to be constantly in conflict. Even if they would use the rhetoric of our revolution, we know that we would get involved in something that would be something else. Right? It would be about avarice, envy, ambition. It would usurp the standard of freedom. The fundamental maxims of her policy would insensibly change from liberty to force. She might become the dictatress of the world. She would be no longer the ruler of her own spirit.
America's glory is not dominion but liberty.
America's glory is dominion but not liberty. Her march is of the mind. She is the spear and the shield, but the motto upon her shield is freedom, independence, and peace. And of course, if you look at his first annual address once he becomes president, one of the things so controversial and got him into so much problems was the fact that he proposed that that the federal government should create a national university, that it should construct astronomical observatories, all kinds of things, you know, for the mind and for learning and science and things like that. That, you know, for us, you know, most people today think makes sense, but at that time, it was very it was not seen as what government should
not
do.
Not seen as what government should do. Government, you know, one of the things that, and I'm interested in this with Jackson, because one of the things that Jackson, the period of Jackson, seems to reveal is a transition from the idea that government's role ought to be negative. The government's job is to protect property, protect freedom, protect rights, etc., to something that government actually can do things for people.
It's active.
It can be a positive good for
active.
People. And you see that transition in the Jackson period. And, of course, once people accept government as a doer of good, then the question is, who do you do it for? You know, I mean, which groups ought to be the principal beneficiaries of government? And then you get the debate about the corporations and whether government ought to be helping business or whether government ought to be helping people or these kinds of debates.
We only have just a little more than a half an hour.
We're
so
rolling along here.
Rolling.
Go ahead.
I was going to use this letter from Jefferson and James Monroe about these questions as well. And I would really encourage our participants to look at that letter, especially if you're going to select that particular option in terms of the Monroe Doctrine. He says a lot of the same things. This is, of course, Jefferson's letter to James Monroe, and I just want to kind of use it just a little bit because I want to talk a little bit about Jackson as well. But he's talking about Europe. And he says that our first and fundamental maxim should be never to entangle ourselves in the broils of Europe. And so that's pretty consistent. I mean, and the Washington administration, once the French Revolution became radical, and the king was executed in January of 1793, and it was clear that Prussia and Austria would go to war, and then later Britain would go to war with France. The radical government, revolutionary government, wanted the United States to honor the Treaty of 1778. And, of course, Washington does what every American president does after that, all the way up into FDR, whenever there's a European conflict, he declared neutrality. Of course, Jefferson contended that you couldn't do that on the basis of strict construction, that the Constitution does not specifically say that the president can declare the United States neutral. Hamilton thought that was beside the point, and he also argued that the Treaty of 1778 was irrelevant, because it was with the king, not with the nation. But here we see Jefferson kind of echoing this idea of not getting involved in European conflicts. That was a threat early on for the United States. And we did finally kind of get kind of swung into the situation with the War of 1812. There was always that possibility that we could get kind of sucked into a larger conflict. But he's talking about what the United States could do. He says, our second principle should never to suffer Europe to intermeddle with the cis-Atlantic affairs, right? We shouldn't allow them to become involved in the Americas, right? In fact, later on, and he talks about how the one nation that's probably the most dangerous to us is Great Britain. It's the one that can probably do us the most harm. Great Britain is the nation which can do us the most harm of anyone or all on earth, and with her on her side, we need not fear the whole world. Canning's saying in his letter to Richard Rush, we need to cooperate. The Metternich system, the Congress system, of course, wants to impose the old imperial control on parts of the New World. We need to resist it. The British were making money trading with those new republics.
Right.
And so, it will be British naval power that will enforce the Monroe Doctrine.
Right.
Until the 1880s, 1890s, when we really developed it.
So, in a sense, Great Britain's self-interest is actually becoming our self-interest as well.
And he says that we should most sedulously, consistently, cherish a cordial friendship, and nothing would tend more to knit our affections than to be fighting once more side by side in the same cause. Of course, Alexander Hamilton's been dead for almost 20 years. He would have loved to have heard that.
Jefferson talking about Great Britain with that.
That would have been incredible from his point. And, Jefferson says, we should listen to Canning here. And I really would encourage you to kind of look at this document, those of you especially on that Monroe Doctrine.
Can I make one comment about that document? Later on in the document, he refers to Cuba.
Yes.
And yes. And and Jefferson points out that if there's one part of the Western Hemisphere that logically ought to become part of under our control, it's Cuba.
Yeah, here it is. He says, do we wish to acquire to our own Confederacy any one or more of the Spanish provinces? He's writing in response to Monroe's right. asking for advice, and he says, I candidly confess that I have ever looked on Cuba as the most interesting addition which could ever be made to our system of states. This is long before Theodore Roosevelt, long before the right. Spanish-American War. The control which with Florida appoint this island would give us over the Gulf of Mexico and the countries and isthmus bordering on it, as well as all those whose waters flow into it, would fill up the measure of our political well-being. Cuba was something that, you know, early American leaders certainly were interested in, as they were Canada.
Right. The point that I was going to make, though, is then he goes on to talk about how this is not going to happen.
Not now.
But he does not say it's not going to happen because it shouldn't happen. In other words, he's contradicting what he said earlier about America's principles are that we don't interfere in politics of Europe, but that they don't interfere over here. And basically his argument seems to be that everybody has their right to their own independence. Then he starts talking about Cuba. He never acknowledges the right of the Cuban people to their own independence. He said, basically, this is the one area that I think probably ought to be ours, but it's not going to happen. But never does he say it shouldn't happen because right. it would be a violation of our Declaration of Independence.
Right. No, he doesn't. He doesn't
we would think. Violate our principles if we secured. He never says that.
No, he doesn't say it. And the idea, I think in the Monroe Doctrine, basically, this is what it's about. The idea is that this part of the world is ours.
So you ultimately.
And we will expand here.
So you ultimately take what you want and then you justify it.
Yeah, yeah. But of course, obviously, of course, this becomes part of the debate when you look
but
at
the But on the other hand, if you yeah. create a political system there like ours, mm-hmm. then you're bringing freedom to people that don't
right.
have it.
But are you going to be willing to do that? And that was, if you look at the debate over Cuba as we're getting involved in the 1890s, imperialists and anti-imperialists, the arguments they made, imperialists often make the argument. Of course, you know, Theodore Roosevelt and Henry Cabot Lodge did not want to be called imperialists. They like to be called expansionists, right? But if you look at anti-imperialists like Thomas Reed or even like Mark Twain, they tend to argue that there's no way that we're going to make Cuba an equal state with any of the states within the United States. We would be including populations that, in their viewpoints, were racially inferior.
Right.
And therefore, I mean, Woodrow Wilson, what did he say about the Filipinos, that they were not a self-governing people? And so, I mean, there is a kind of a sense, I think even back here at Jefferson, that, you know, we want Europe to stay out, but in essence, you know, eventually this is going to be ours. John Quincy Adams, another doctor, don't have that. He described Cuba as like fruit. It's just not quite ready to pick.
Low-hanging fruit.
Yes, yeah. It's just not quite ready to pick. I mean, it's there. Oh, you know, it would be great for us, you know, but it's not quite ready to pick. You know, Spain's not quite ready to to be kicked out of the New World yet, but, you know, there it is. Oh, if we could only acquire it. So, I mean, this idea that the United States was, in essence, isolationist, I think is very, very questionable.
So, but what you've in a sense said, though, is that the doctrines which John Quincy Adams said is our America's contribution to the world become rather contradictory and difficult for us mm-hmm. when we begin to proceed as a nation among the world of other nations.
As a great power. It's one thing when you're not a great power, when you're not a major military naval power. When we joined the club,
our own principles kind of trip us up occasionally.
To some degree, the difficulty of a representative government, you know, actually formulating.
I don't know if you've done this, and I don't want to throw you a curveball here, but I'm thinking of the people that are listening. What about teaching this to youngsters? I mean, how do you teach this to kids? I mean, do you? How much of this do you get into? Do you? I think what you could probably do is talk about how the how principle can sometimes trip you up.
Yeah.
Because if you are consistent with your principle, sometimes it creates very embarrassing situations. I don't mean to imply, and I don't think anybody wants to teach youngsters that we kind of didn't believe what we were about.
Right.
I think very honestly we did believe it.
Yeah.
And because these people struggled and wrestled with what they saw as contradictions. I mean, that's what Lincoln does with slavery. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's wrestling constantly with slavery is so inconsistent with everything we're about as a nation. I mean, it's genuine. He's not playing games.
No, he's not.
He's very sincere.
Yeah, I mean, does he use emancipation as a strategic tactic, as a strategic tool? Yes. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he had said numerous times before the war even down. I mean, he said once that if slavery isn't wrong, then nothing is wrong.
Right.
Right, and so, yeah, there isn't that inconsistency, the difference between principles and practice, is something that I think, I would argue, that representative governments especially have difficulty with. I mean, even if you go back to, like, Athens, mm-hmm. right? The Athens that executed Socrates, right? The Athens, of learning, the democracy of Athens executes a philosopher in 399 B.C. Also, Athens in its war with Sparta, some of its actions in the Delian League and against Sparta are not consistent with the principles that they espouse in terms of their own citizens.
So
not consistent with what Pericles supposedly says.
So it's the
funeral oration.
It's the old idea. It's one thing to say that you stand for something, for principle. It's another thing to live it.
It's a harder, it's difficult,
it's harder
when
to
you
live
have
it.
To make those decisions. Yeah.
It's harder to live it. It's exactly.
Whereas in, like,
And I think in this course, my guess is that what Gordon Wood's going to point out is that it became very difficult for the United States to continue to deal with the principles that the founders had established, mm-hmm. given issues that we were dealing with,
right.
Like in foreign policy, like slavery, like, you know.
Like I don't think Kevin Shanley had a chance to really get into it, but, you know, I think the one thing that destroyed the Confederacy's attempts to gain any recognition was the fact that they had slavery.
Yeah.
I mean, Lord Lyon, who was the British minister to the United States, writing back to London, says that the taint of slavery, and I quote, the taint of slavery will cause them to be, I can't remember exactly the phrasing, disdained by the entire civilized world or something like that. In other words, the stigma of slavery was something the Confederacy never could get around.
Right.
And they never could get others to accept them,
right.
Other members of the powers of the world, to accept them as a nation to a large degree because they were a government put together to defend slavery.
Do you think that the difficulty that the South had with slavery, the fact that you just said they couldn't get around it, do you think that that reality is proof positive as to the power of the values and the ideals of the founders? In other words, it seems to me that what creates a problem for the South is that they can't justify their right to be independent from the Union without coming to grips with the realities of what the founders were about. You couldn't ignore them because they were too important. You had to find a way to use the founders to justify what you want to do. Mm-hmm. And they tried to do that.
Unsuccessfully.
Yeah.
And especially in terms of the court of world public opinion. Very much unsuccessfully.
Right.
I kind of want to move along here a little bit to something else.
Go ahead. You better do it. You control this. You got the button.
I have the button, but kind of move away from foreign policy a little bit and to kind of think a little bit about, let's say, nullification. and the nature of the union. They disagree. There's disagreements in terms of the nature of the union very early on, and that certainly is something that's intensified, especially during Jackson's presidency, especially with the nullification crisis. And what I want to kind of do is maybe look at a couple of documents dealing with Jackson and the nullification crisis. This is a political cartoon. I don't know how well they can see that, but I've always thought that political cartoons are very useful, for teaching history without a doubt. And this one's not that hard to interpret. I mean, this is obviously Jackson's opponents, portraying Jackson as being too assertive a leader, right? Someone who is, of course, stepping on the Constitution.
Stepping on the Constitution.
Yeah, he's stepping on the Constitution. He's the king. In fact, this political cartoon has a title, King Andrew I. He has a veto in his hand. He uses the veto, the presidential veto, more than every president before him combined. So, I mean, he's very much aggressive in terms of the use of the veto. If you really like a lot of information about Jackson's presidency, I'd recommend this book, by the way. I'm not really going to use anything from it. But this is John Meacham, American Lion. And you can find this book everywhere. It's relatively new. I can tell you when it was published, but 2008. It's in paperback. I've seen it on sale and like in Books a Million. And John Meacham, of course, and some of you have seen him maybe on Morning Joe. He wrote a book about the relationship between Franklin, Roosevelt, and Winston Churchill. Phenomenal narrative.
Is he the editor of Newsweek?
He's the editor of Newsweek, so he can write. Yeah. That's the point. But it's also very, very thoughtful, good narrative history. It tells you about, especially if you're interested in, for example, the Indian policy, all the other, the personality conflicts within the Jackson administration. That's a great source. I mean, there are a lot of good books on Jackson. The Age of Jackson by Schlesinger, of course, a well-known work. Even though I've always thought, I don't know how you feel about this, but I've always thought that in The Age of Jackson, Schlesinger sees Andrew Jackson through the prism of FDR because he worked for FDR. So the kitchen cabinet looks a lot like the brain trust.
He evaluates every president, positives and negatives, from the position of FDR.
100 days, right.
Total supporter of FDR. In the New Deal.
FDR was a divisive character. Not quite as divisive as Andrew Jackson. Right. I mean, but
so in that sense, I mean, you could say and be right, conservatives are right, that history like Schlesinger's Age of Jackson is written from a liberal perspective because he is a New Deal Democrat. And he's writing history from that perspective. There's no question.
Yeah.
Conservatives are right.
You know? Yeah, he's certainly using FDR as a model of what leadership should be,
what a good president should be.
And so he kind of reads that back into Jackson. I think there's no doubt about that he does it. Of course, Robert Remini is probably the classic
study of Jackson.
But it's two volumes. It's, not exactly
it's a little bit
manageable.
A little bit more than most people.
This is just about the presidency. This is very, very manageable, easy to find, really an excellent book, without a doubt. I highly recommend that.
And again, you can get it on Kindle. It doesn't.
Oh, yeah, that's a newer book, so there's no doubt about that. There's a lot written on H.W. Brands also wrote a pretty good one-volume biography of Jackson. If you really kind of wanted, a narrative of the political chaos or things like the Peggy O'Neill Eaton affair, where Jackson's cabinet members will not have anything to do with Mrs. Eaton because of her colorful past. One of those was John C. Calhoun's wife, who would have nothing to do with her. And, of course, Jackson's upset by this, has cabinet meetings about it, trying to force them to, of course, have social dealings with her. And Martin Van Buren, who's a widower, of course, can dance with her and get her punch at the dances and really scores huge points with Jackson as a result. But, of course, Jackson confronts the whole nature of can the Union be violated? Is it a compact of sovereign states or not? And he does that in the nullification crisis over the tariff. Ironically, his real opponent there would be, in many ways, his vice president, John C. Calhoun. I think I have have something here. Here it is. On a Jefferson Day dinner in April of 1830, Jackson, who was concerned that there were so many Southerners at this dinner who were advocates of kind of nullification, and we'll talk a little bit more about nullification in a moment, but Jackson rose and gave this toast. He said, "Our federal union, it must be preserved." And Calhoun responded, "You know, the union next to our liberty most dear, may we all remember that it can only be preserved by respecting the rights of the states and by distributing equally the benefits and burdens of the union." And so there's a little bit of butting heads between these two early on. And the issue of nullification and the tariff is the big thing because, of course, you know, Calhoun writes the South Carolina Exposition in protest, and he's really echoing, I think, the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions of Jefferson
and Madison. Yeah.
You know, the idea that, you know, if a state feels that a law is unconstitutional, they can nullify it within their own boundaries. And South Carolina actually nullifies the tariff.
Right.
Of course, you know, the South had reasons, obviously, to oppose tariffs. They were producing staple crops. By this point, 59% of exports out of the United States actually came out of the American South. Their economy was essentially colonial. In a way, they never stopped being colonial. They're producing these staple goods, and they're, of course, buying manufactured goods either from the North or, of course, from Britain.
Right.
Of course, the tariffs artificially raise the price of British goods. And so it means, like, for cloth, for example, you know, you would have to pay more to clothe your slaves. In fact, slavery and nullification are very much tied together. That's one thing I think that a lot of times gets left by the wayside here is an attempt on many people to kind of divorce these kind of concepts, the states' rights concepts, with slavery. But I think I have something here from Calhoun. I'll go forward to
go
it.
Ahead.
And here's Calhoun, and this is a selection from a letter that he writes September 11th, 1830, to Virgil Maxey, who was a politician from Maryland. And we must remember Maryland was a slave state, southern state. Sometimes we don't think of that way today, but that certainly is the case in the 19th century. You know that, because I know you've done quite a bit of research on Maryland. But he says, you know, and he's very candid, and he's talking, you know, kind of off the record, and he says, "I consider the tariff but as the occasion rather than the real cause of the present unhappy state of things. The truth can no longer be disguised." And if you say that the truth can no longer be disguised, you are saying that it has been disguised.
Right.
That the peculiar domestic, with the K, right, domestic institution of the southern states and the consequent direction which that and her soil and climate has given her to industry have placed them in regard to taxation appropriations is opposite the relation of the majority of the union. And so he's coming flat out and saying that essentially nullification is intertwined with slavery and the defense of slavery. And of course Calhoun is, of course, very much well known for the defense of slavery. And the reason I kind of point to this is Calhoun, in essence, is a founding father of the Confederacy. He dies before the war. He dies well before the war, in the early 1850s. But when we get to looking at the founding of the Confederacy, and you get to looking at documents like the Declaration of the Causes of Secession, or what one thing we could do in a future chat is compare and contrast the United States Constitution with the Confederate Constitution.
Right.
What you find is that the framers of the Confederacy, this would be my interpretation, what they did was essentially construct a system that was designed to secure and protect the institution of slavery, which was vital to their own, we're talking about the planter class, their own economic power and their own political power. And so Calhoun's saying that right out in the open here, right, that, you know, the real fear here to a degree is going to be possibly the destruction of slavery.
Well, these people today, the folks today who argue that the Civil War was really over the nature of the Union,
states
the structure
rights,
of the states' rights, here's Calhoun saying that the states' rights issue is a ruse.
Yeah,
the real issue is slavery. And we might as well admit that.
It can't be disguised. You know,
right.
Might as well defend it. And in fact, one book that I pointed to, and I'll kind of show it here again, I talked about this past summer, is Apostles of Disunion, right? And I'll talk about it probably in the future, Charles Dew. In fact, Jonathan Berkey and I, who teach a Civil War course at Verconk, we teach it together. We've used this semester. What this is, these are secession commissioners and their speeches to various state legislatures, the deep southern states that left the Union initially, sent commissioners to all the other southern slave states, Maryland, Virginia, right, Kentucky, et cetera, to try to persuade them to secede from the Union. These documents, and he has some of them actually in the appendix, and I have a website that has all the commissioner's speeches on it. They are blatantly straightforward about what we're doing. And they, I mean, for example, they go to these legislatures and they say, you know, if we stay in the Union and Lincoln's president, slavery will be killed, slavery will be done, our society will be over, there will be racial intermixing, there will be racial degradation. They say it flat out.
Right.
And I think the framers of the Confederacy do say it flat out in 1860 and 1861. But what they say in 1880 and 1881 is it was constitutional principle. I mean, how are you going to say we led you into a war and we slaughtered such a large portion of the population
to defend an institution that only a few of us...
It's gone.
Yeah,
that only a few... I mean, 75% of us do not even own slaves. And so, you know, that elite had an intrinsic interest in that institution. Right. And Calhoun acknowledged that, right?
So what he's basically saying here is that all the arguments about the real conflict between the South and the Union is over the tariff and is over the structure of the Union and what the power of the federal government is or isn't, what the Constitution says and doesn't say. That all of that's a cover for the real issue.
What he's saying is fundamentally the most important.
Where I'm going with this, and I'm taking this into today's politics.
Yeah.
But what I'm basically saying, and the people today who are arguing about an overbearing federal government under the Obama administration, for example, overregulating industry and overregulating coal and overregulating the environment, the EPA, and all of this, is, you know, are we dealing with a situation where people are getting their arguments from people that really didn't believe the arguments when they made them?
I don't know. I mean, I think that, you know, a lot of people did believe that, you know, a lot of Southerners did believe that the nature of the Union was a compact. But I think this is certainly a telling moment on Calhoun's part. And what you're talking about.
Because Rick Perry's talking about Texas,
the right of Texas
to secede.
Well, in many ways, I think, you know, the Tea Party, I mean, I think I see quite a bit more Jefferson Davis in them than Thomas Jefferson.
Yeah, I understand.
And I think that they are very much
one of the things that, one of the things that has always intrigued me here is that very early on in the nation's history, and we're talking about the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions against the Alien and Sedition Acts, 10 years after the Constitution is ratified, 11 years after the Constitution is ratified, and the guy that is most instrumental in the Constitution itself, which is Madison, drafts the compact theory. Basically, what I hear this as being
Virginia
is
Resolution.
The guy that writes the Constitution is saying the only way you can challenge the power of this government under the system which I drafted is by arguing that it's a compact of the states.
Right.
And then you go back and you look at ratification, And the debates at the Constitutional Convention, and Madison said it's very important that that not the states ratify the Constitution, but conventions of the people in the states.
Right.
Because if the people create the Constitution, then the federal government becomes superior over the states.
Which is exactly, by the way, what if you look at Daniel Webster in his second reply to Hayne in the Webster-Hayne debate, that's exactly what he says. Points right directly to that. He says, "It's not that the states are sovereign. The government is a government, popular government of the people,
right.
people." And so he's directly referring to that
right.
when he's responding to Hayne, who's, of course, arguing for nullification.